today, finally, Crips event that takes place. Thanks to all of you for being here, especially to Matt Watson, who is going to talk about the Research Excellence Framework. Briefly, it's called the REF. And Matt is an expert on all kinds of markets, and this is a very specific market, the academic market, that he's going to talk about today. And thank you for coming along. Please.
Well, it's my pleasure. What I don't want to do is scare you in any way while talking about the REF. So this is just meant to be a bit of background to give you a sense of what the rest of us mean when you find us stopped in the corridor talking to one another about REF. REF is a strange thing. It's there, it's part of our everyday existence as academics, but not many people know a great deal about it. Even fewer people really want to go and read the huge documents that Hefke prepares to tell you how it is that you're going to be REF ready or not. So REF does stand for the Research Excellence Framework, and it's the evolving form of oversight of research in the UK. It's had various different justifications. The original justification for introducing what used to be called the research assessment exercise was that this would be able to demonstrate that academics were offering value for money to the public purse. Obviously, within the context of the recent changes to higher education, there are some departments, ours is one of them, that doesn't have any public funding at all. So a new justification has had to be generated to justify continuing to put us through this process of oversight. From 2014, the REF process that we've just gone through, there has been a name change from Research Assessment Exercise to Research Excellence Framework. And so no longer is this about assessing research in a way that allows value for money to be demonstrated. This is about attempting to capture excellence, to be able to show where excellence is concentrated within the UK higher education environment, and also as a means of that, to help consumers of higher education make informed decisions as to the best place that they can go to study. So this is all part of the developing league table society, which has blighted the public services in this country for the last 30 years and more. This is all about trying to produce information for the users of higher education to be able to make more informed decisions. Unfortunately, the information that comes out of all of these processes is inherently contested. One of the reasons that it's contested is because during RAE 2008, Hefke made a severe mistake. They told everyone that there was going to be one dominant metric that would judge where you were to finish in the relevant league table, and that was going to be your overall GPA score on the RAE assessment, I'll talk more about this later on, divided by how many people that you submitted. So if you submitted 100% of your staff, your research active staff, to the research assessment exercise and scored a GPA at that level, you would obviously come out on top of somebody who'd only submitted 50% of their staff but got a GPA at that level. So this was meant to be the overall research power indicator. Unfortunately, in the documents that Hefke produced about how the research power figure would be calculated, there were inconsistencies. And a number of higher education institutions spotted that inconsistency, strategically undersubmitted their staff. So they cherry-sliced all of those that they thought were going to be the most highly performing RAE stars. And they threatened Hefke with legal action if Hefke then moved to the final stage of the research power indication. So the league tables that we have at the moment are driven by a series of metrics that Hefke never thought were going to be authoritative. They thought there was an extra step in the process which they were unable to activate. For REF 2014, however, they've been quite clear that this second stage in the process will happen. But this hasn't stopped different universities from taking a very different approach to how many members of staff they want to submit. Warwick has been particularly inclusive and particularly democratic in this respect. It has instructed its departments, like us, to get as many of their staff onto the submission as possible. And we submitted 97% of our staff to the REF 2014. There are other departments who think that they're just as good as us, or even better than us, who have submitted anything down to only 40% of their staff. In other words, the majority of their staff, for strategic reasons, have been left off. That they've concentrated all of their REF activity on a so-called number, or a number of so-called REF stars, and they're going for the bald GPA figure, not the deflated figure for how many people that you submit. So what's going to end up at the conclusion of this process is that there's going to be two completely different lead tables for all subject fields. So we've gone through the whole process of submitting all of our documents for REF 2014. Our colleagues who are on the REF subpanel, more of which are none, have gone through the whole process of reading through everything and making professional judgments on everything. A huge amount of time and resources has been extracted from the sector to make us fit for this. And at the end of it all, I very strongly fear that there will be two competing lead tables. And what are departments going to do? They're going to cite the lead table and all of their website material that they're higher up on. So I suspect there will be at least 10 departments of politics by the end of this process who will all tell you that they're in the top five in the lead table, because they'll be appealing to different lead tables. There will also be people working feverishly away in every central administration, in every university around the country, thinking of different ways of presenting the final data. Because they will know that there are different ways of presenting the final data which supposedly elevate them higher up the league tables. So all universities will be playing the same game of not only trying to get themselves as high up the official league tables, but of trying to devise unofficial league tables to their own benefit that place them even higher. So if this is a process that's meant to bring clarity, that's meant to bring transparency, and meant to bring a genuine sense of how the profession stacks up and where the best departments are, if you think you're going to be able to look come December the 19th on all politics departments' website and get a sense of that clarity and that transparency, unfortunately you are mistaken. There will be a lot of politics being played with the numbers at that point, with every department in the country trying to find another metric, another indicator that places them further up than the official list does. So this is a process which is fraught with difficulties because we're just not quite sure how the process itself is going to run through. And perhaps understandably, it's a process that's been challenged within academia. When you Google image RAE and REF, you get more of this sort of stuff than the official logos. Here's one that shows what lots of academics think about the REE process, that it should be something that's objected to. Here's what they think about the REF process. This is quite interesting, all this graffiti here, because this is the REF 2014, its official strapline is publications, submissions, excellence. And this person's crossed out publications and just put it's all about the submission. In other words, it's all about the game that you can play. So there are a significant number of objections from within the academic profession to the REF process. At the same time, we all know that if we did opt out of it, it would mean that we would lead to the complete destruction of our own departments. To be not playing the REF game is worse than to be forced to play the REF game. This is one of those caught between a rock and a hard stone situations. So the types of objections you hear from academics, there are some objections in principle that some academics will say that there shouldn't be this sense of oversight at all because professional standards and professional ethics are enough to make sure that we do good research and that we do good research for the right reasons. I think that's quite a compelling argument, but it doesn't get around the fact that any department that managed to opt out or decided to opt out of this is only doing themselves damage. There are also objections in principle that why does the government have oversight of the research that comes out of departments that it now doesn't fund? Because for all the social science departments, for all the arts and humanities departments, there isn't a single penny of public money that now goes into those departments in UK universities. And yet there is still this colossal oversight that's being driven by the Department of Education, and that's clearly a problem as well. There are also objections in principle about the fact that some of the things that are now part of the overall metric of the final REF result are not considered by lots of academics to actually be part of their job. So our job is being expanded to fit the metrics rather than the metrics reflecting what we would consider to be parts of our job, and more on that anon as well. And I think there are also deep concerns about the effect that this has on workload, that academic time is obviously limited, however many times you wish you could get up in the morning having cloned yourself, so there's two of you or three of you working on that particular day. It doesn't work like that, unfortunately. And so there are bigger demands being made on every aspect of our activities as academics, and this just seems to multiply those. There are also objections in practice about the way that this works out, its underlying modus operandi. It's there to try to capture research excellence, but nobody's ever delivered anything that looks like compelling evidence that this has done anything at all to increase the quality of academic research that's undertaken in this country. Quantity, yes. There are now many more journals publishing many more articles than there used to be when I started. But quantity and quality are not necessarily the same thing. Is academic research getting better because of REF, or does REF actually get in the way of good academic research? I think there are strong arguments for saying the latter. So this is something that we're having to learn to live with, but it's something that I think sits uneasily on our shoulders, that we can see all of the problems here, that this is being driven by political decisions being made by government and not what's good for the university sector as a whole. Another objection in practice would be that this can lead to some rather conservative appointment processes. Lots of the really exciting work that can be done is work that's done on a bit of a wing and a prayer. You don't know where it's going to until maybe 10 years after you've finished it. You don't know whether it's insightful, whether it's an actual breakthrough in research terms. And there is an incentive for academic employers now to overlook that sort of appeal within academic work and go for a much more conservative appointment policy. There is also a good objection in principle that this somehow breaks the rhythm of academic research, that it sets these artificial deadlines in place, and that everyone has to be REF ready at the end of every 6-year period. So what happens if the sort of research you're doing has a genesis that's beyond 6 years? And if you think about some of the most famous names in our field, they wouldn't have been able to survive beyond one REF period, because when they were starting out, building their academic career, building their reputation, getting on the way to writing the books for which they are now best known, they weren't publishing 4 pieces of work every 6 years. Here's some examples. Anyone know who this is? Oh, it's a bit grainy. It's John Rawls. I think without doubt the most important Anglo-liberal philosopher in the second half of the 20th century, maybe in the whole of the 20th century. 12 years between him taking up his first job and the publication that made his name, The Theory of Justice. And nothing else was written by Rawls in that period. If he'd have been employed in a modern day UK university with the REF looking over his shoulder, then he would never have stayed in a job long enough to have written A Theory of Justice. I presume more of you do know who that is. It's the same story with Judith Butler, that the work for which she is best known took a number of years to produce. It wasn't something that she was able to ram into the constraints of a REF period. It was something that grew more organically beyond that. A lot of my research is in the field of economics, so here's two other examples. Anyone know who that is? The Nobel Prize for Economics, not a proper Nobel Prize, of course, but what's called the Nobel Prize for Economics is the most gendered Nobel Prize out there. This is the only woman who's ever won a Nobel Prize in economics. Does that give you any clues?
Eleanor
Ostrom. And here's a particular favourite of mine, the Bourbakist mathematician Gerard de Breuer, who lived pretty much all of his public and intellectual life in silence. He thought that it was absolutely clear within the mathematical structure of his economics what he was trying to say. He didn't feel any need to actually go out and tell anyone what it was that he was trying to say. The idea of being required to undertake extensive public engagement with non-academic user groups would have horrified de Breuer. He'd have run a million miles from a situation like that. So here's four really, really, really eminent social scientists whose work, for which they are best known, simply does not fit the structure, the natural rhythms of their work does not fit the structure of REF. So what are the things that are changing within the research assessment exercise? So how does this look different to when I first started? Well, back in the mid-1980s, which is even before my academic career began, the first research assessment exercise required every institution simply to submit four pieces of work from across each subject field. So our department of 70 odd people, however many we've got now, we would only in those days have needed to find four pieces of work from across the whole of the academic staff. And I think we probably submitted four prize winning books amongst our submission this time, so it probably just have been that. Thank goodness we poached Stuart Eldon in the final few months of the REF period. So that's one of the things that's changed. It's become more universal, more inclusive. The idea now is that you should submit everyone if you can do. Not all institutions, of course, decide that they're going to submit everyone, but if you can do, you should submit as many people as possible. But this is the other big thing that's changed, which you will have heard academics bellyaching about endlessly, I would imagine, impact. For REF 2014, they introduced a new measure. Previously, there had been three parts of the research assessment exercise submission. Publications, a strange thing called environment, where you have to create a narrative of your own activities and why that signifies excellence and the contribution you're making to the research base more generally. And in the old days, something called esteem. So all those signals of esteem, what it was that you could say your members of staff had been invited to do, which brought some degree of recognition and some degree of additional reputation into the department. Esteem is now gone, and esteem has been replaced by impact. And impact is about research having a demonstrable effect. See, I can't even say it, let alone do it. Research having a clear and unequivocal effect. I got that word wrong as well. I'm just going to go for clear this time. Research having a clear effect on non-academic user groups. So the use of academic research to make a change in attitudes, behaviour or policy somewhere within society. Now, this is something that gets lots of academics very, very nervous. I think that this is something that if I don't talk to you about, it might make you very nervous as well. But the good thing about impact is that impact is generally thought to be those things that the older members of staff are meant to be doing, so those with most experience. Nobody's going to ask you at a job interview in the next couple of years what sort of impact would you bring to the department with you, because you would say, well, actually, as you know, impact doesn't travel. So anything that I'd done that was impactful beforehand cannot be taken with me as I move jobs. But there is, I think, a fear even now amongst the PhD community that that impact does affect you. I'm not sure you can see this cartoon, but I presume this is the prosecution for the Council for the Prosecution. And there's this poor young woman in the dock there, and he's saying to her, "You then struck the intruder with a bound PhD thesis. And here's the intruder. We shouldn't really have a great deal of sympathy for him, even though he's covered in bandages. To which her response was, yes, it was research with impact. Now, not the best joke you've ever heard, but I think it gets to the heart of some of the concerns about, do you have to now, even now, be writing a PhD, which has some obvious connection to research impact? And the very, very straightforward answer is no, you don't. If it does, great, but you shouldn't artificially create a PhD specifically so it hits these impact targets. But there is so much confusion surrounding impact. And I show this slide for no reason other than the fact that I've got a bet running. This started off in March when I first confessed to having a picture of a confused cat in a PowerPoint presentation. And I took a bet on that I wouldn't be able to put in the picture of the confused cat in every other PowerPoint presentation I gave for the rest of the calendar year. I've just got three left now, and I'm still in the lead on this bet. So as long as in my last three presentations I remember to do it, I'm going to be quitting. Although I'm not, because the person that I had this bet with is legendary for not paying up when she loses. This is the usual look that comes on my colleagues' faces when we talk about impact as well. I think there are some horror stories about impact, that this must all be about you cozying up to some friendly policymaker who's going to see the wisdom that had eluded them previously simply because they've read some of your work, and then they're going to change the whole setting of policy on that basis. Now, Richard Aldridge, during his time as our director of research, he had a wonderful phrase for this. He called it the spoon-bending approach to impact. And great, if you do the sort of work that can have a measurable effect on policy, that's fantastic. But also, presumably, the vast majority of us who work in politics department don't. So we have to find other ways of doing that. And thankfully, Hefke helps us out here because it gives us a range of different ways in which you can do impact. So having an effect on policy is one. Changing attitudes within society is another. Educating the public more broadly is a third. Outreach with schools is a fourth. There are a whole series of ways in which you can do impact, which comes out of your academic work, but doesn't mean that you somehow have to be the sort of person who glides easily through the corridors of power in Whitehall and is able to get civil servants to rewrite policy on the basis of your insights. So thankfully, the crossbar isn't always set that high. There are lots of very innovative ways that we can do impact, and I think lots of very exciting ways that we can do impact, which hopefully takes away the whole of the scare element from it. So those slides were meant to be just the basic background. It sounds as though I banged on for a bit too long already. Let me move on. What I ask in this slide, and this is for the sake of the recording, what does this mean for me as a PhD student? Well, for almost all of you, apart from our new first years, welcome to our new first years, you've already been part of one ref submission because we have to report the trends within our PhD programme. One section of the ref submission is called Ref 4, which is just data. So that's the section where we report trends in our PhD programme, which Ref thinks are very important. And there's been good news and nothing other than good news for us to report on that. So thank you very much, all of you, for your help with that. And also we report all of our research income, which always feels a little bit grubby. Having to show off about how much money you've made through research income. It's much nicer to be able to say good stories about our PhD programme. And secondly, there has been a huge number of good news stories that we've been able to say about our PhD programme. One of the decisions I made, because I was responsible for writing the environment document, I'll tell you more about this in a second. The environment document is meant to capture that sense of who you think you are as a research active department, the successes you have, the way that you want to pitch yourself in relation to the profession as a whole. And we put a lot of emphasis on what we think is actually the best thing that we do, and that's bringing young scholars through both as PhD students and as postdoctoral fellows, and of replenishing the profession from the bottom upwards. So while lots of other departments would have said, well, we managed to appoint big nose professors, somebody or other, and this shows just what sort of ambition we have, we told our ambitions as a department in a very different way. We thought that it was more important to focus on our successes from the bottom up, rather than just name dropping one or two people from the department from the top down. Just as an example of this, here are three indicators that you can see. I got to know our environment document really rather well over the 30 odd drafts that I had to write of it, and that it's almost a year ago now since we submitted everything, and I still know most of the figures in those 9,000 words that I had to write. Our Deputy Vice Chancellor at the time was particularly impressed that we'd managed to source PhD studentships from 50 different funding arrangements, and he thought this was probably a record in the whole of the university. He hadn't seen anyone else being able to say that 50 different types of PhD studentship had been held within one department in one ref cycle. So we were really proud about that. We were also proud about the fact that 66 PhD students of submitted members of staff had gone on from our PhD programme into an academic post of some sort in those 6 years. Given that BISA, the British International Studies Association, last time it did some number crunching on this, it thought that only 10% of the people who wanted an academic job across the UK as a whole coming out of PhD programmes got one. We're at about three quarters of our PhD students who want an academic job have been able to find one in the last ref period. So that puts us batting above the national average by a factor of about 7.5. So that's not too bad, is it? And one of the reasons for that, we had Andy looking into the publications from our coming out of our PhD programme. 78 publications in that 6 year period in peer-reviewed journal articles. No, articles in peer-reviewed journals. That's fantastic. That's amazing. And so we wanted to sing as loudly as possible about all of these successes. So we did put you right at the front of the narrative that we were constructing about ourselves as to why the REF panel should take us seriously as a department that has not only the best interests of researchers at heart, but the best interests of the research community and helping to build that research community from the ground up. So that's how you've already been involved in our REF submission, but you'll also have come into contact with lots and lots of people talking at various stages about REF things. And this, I suspect, is one of the most unfortunate influences of REF, that it has changed the way in which academics think about their job. And it's changed the way that academics think about their job, not necessarily for the best. That I think it's become almost impossible for us not to incorporate and assimilate a lot of the language and a lot of the expectations about REF. You see here where I put, it influences the way that we pass judgment on one another. This is nowhere more obviously seen than in appointment panels. Certainly in the second half of a REF period, the first set of important questions that ever get asked in job interviews are, so what's your REF return going to be? Which becomes unfortunately instrumental, as if the REF return is more important than the underpinning ideas which help to generate that REF return in the first place. So it does have some of these important and not necessarily positive effects. It has, I'm sure, for all of us, at some level or other, changed the way in which we begin to aspire as academics. It changes the context of what we think is reasonable to expect ourselves to do over the short term, over the medium term, and also over the long term. If you can get comfortable with REF in such a way where you don't allow it to shape your aspirations, but your aspirations can be met anyway, while also simultaneously meeting REF targets, then that's clearly the best place to be. But not every academic is anywhere near that, which is why you'll hear at times some of the worried, some of the frustrated, some of the angry conversations that go on between colleagues in the corridor. I think I've already suggested that there is an effect on you in this respect. If you are thinking about an academic career and you're trying to position yourself for one, then being able to signal something that might be called ref readiness is a very important aspect of that. Maybe not necessarily at this stage of the ref cycle, because we've just started a new six-year period, but definitely as we move through and we get towards the halfway point, which might very well be when you're finishing your PhD or beginning to think about finishing your PhD, in the second half of all ref periods, there are more jobs that are available, but the jobs seem to be distributed on that more instrumental basis of what advantages to the overall ref submission you and your work can bring. And this filters all the way down to postdoctoral fellowships as well. So many times now the dividing line between a successful and an unsuccessful postdoc application is whether there are any publications on the CV already. And of course the publication treadmill becomes important simply because of ref. People begin to make judgments on postdoctoral applications because they're already inculcated with the whole ref methodology, which says publish, 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 publish. And so you end up having to demonstrate, simply to get on that first career run of a postdoctoral fellowship, you have to be able to demonstrate that you are somewhere ref compliant or ref compatible. This all sounds like bad news, doesn't it, really? This doesn't sound like a positive account of what's going on. And I think it's all too easy to emphasise those negatives. And I think it's also all too easy to think that ref is actually more important than it is. It's important for departmental managers. It therefore becomes important for people like me who have to guide the department or help guide the department through a ref process. But I don't think it should be seen as the be-all and end-all of any academic's career, and certainly not for you at this stage of your academic careers. I really don't think you need to be scared of ref at all, because a lot of the assumptions that you're probably already incorporated into and acculturated to are the sorts of assumptions that would suggest that you'll be able to cope with ref anyway. I know when I've come to speak to the PhD community before and you ask me to talk on things like how do I get a job, what's a job interview like, the emphasis is so often about publications there, and that is a sign of ref impinging upon the way in which careers are built, but you know all this already. And I'm sure that you, your generation of PhD students, like mine, I think mine was the first generation of RAE responsive PhD students, and so we've known for the last 15 years that publications do become important. It's only those people that somehow forget that that end up getting really worried about ref. And of course the people that forget that are the people that start worrying about ref when it's probably too late. If you are a member of staff and you haven't got any publications at all in this ref period, and somebody asks you in the last year, are you going to get any? Well, it's too late to start worrying about it there, because those publications are just not going to come out in that time period. So I don't think you need to be scared of ref.
But beyond publications, what does ref readiness include?
For you, publications.
Just publications.
Publications. Anything else is an added bonus.
But raising money through research is not something you need to worry about.
No.
At this stage or postdoctoral stage?
No. It's something that you are almost certainly going to get asked whether you have a strategy for that in your interview. But because you know you're almost certainly going to be asked that, you'll have prepared an answer which suggests that yes, you have. But a proven track record on bringing in research funding is certainly not necessary when you go for interviews for your first job. Just to show an awareness that you know that this is part of things that departments now expect, and that you have a strategy for how to do that in the future, that's enough. So at this stage for you, ref readiness does just mean publications. And we can talk about how many and what sort a little bit later, and hopefully in questions. So I think it's all too easy to sit through a talk like this and to think that REF is this omnipresent bogeyman, this thing that sits on your shoulder and whispers nasty thoughts into your ear every moment that you're sitting in front of your computer trying to do your PhD research. Please try to eliminate any such concerns. That REF is there, it is something that we have to get used to, but I think it is possible to take it in your stride. For the benefit of the tape, I've written here, it does not mean that you need to become a walking encyclopedia of REFness if you want to stand any chance of making an academic career for yourself. You can allow other people to become walking encyclopedias of REFness, people like me who get given the job within the department to make sure that the submission is all looking okay. This is not something that you have to fret about at the moment. It certainly doesn't change your PhD either. You should continue to write your PhD in the way that you want to write your PhD, in the way that makes you the most intellectually fulfilled that you can be over these years. You don't have to start thinking, could I write a slightly different sort of PhD, one that I'm maybe not so much into, but which will ring a load of REF bells. Doesn't work like that. If REF is there and can do anything positive at all, it's just to confirm that good work is always going to be good work. So what you really need to be concentrating on is just writing the best, most intellectually engaging PhD that you can do. Let REF take care of itself at some later part of the process. So that, in some way, will be the main message that I keep coming back to, because I don't want to frighten you with any of this. I want to be honest with you and tell you what's going on and the way that academics usually respond to REF demands, but I don't want it to be any more than that. So I want you to get a sense that there might be some pitfalls, some traps that are best avoided, but that's all. I don't want you to go away thinking that I'm telling you to become as much of a REF anorak as, unfortunately, I've had to turn myself into. I still suspect that some of you will be thinking, oh, I'd still better learn more about the REF. And I defy you to get all the way to the end of the REF documents, because they are long and tedious and long and tedious. And if there are two words that I could think to describe REF documents, you've got it. It's long and tedious. Here's their website, www.ref.ac.uk, and it will give you oodles and oodles and oodles of information about exactly what this is all meant to be about. You will see here that there's a section on their front page that says the primary purpose of the REF. And the primary purpose of REF, when condensed into those three points, it makes it sound as though it's just a soft process of collecting information to make sure that everyone knows where excellent research activity is concentrated. It's a lot more intrusive than that. It encroaches a lot more than that. It invites people to play games with the submission to a greater extent than that as well. So don't believe the nice softly approach that it takes on its own website. Previous research assessment exercises have all had the stated goal through the Department of Education of concentrating research funding. In other words, finding a limited number of departments in a limited number of subject fields in a limited number of universities and making sure that all public funding goes to those. In other words, rewarding the institutions that, through a combination of history, landowning and money in the bank, are already privileged. But they've not been able to find a mechanism to do that, because they've been repeatedly surprised by the fact that the most famous universities in the country do not necessarily occupy the top positions in all of the league tables. In fact, there are very few of the league tables where you will find the Oxbridge universities coming first and second in any subject field at all. So the Department for Education has been surprised about this, so it continues to have to rethink its own justification for what it's doing here. You'll see that there's some news that I found on the website on Saturday when I was putting this together. The REF outcomes, we all knew this already, will be published on the 18th of December 2014. The university is expecting our department to do well. Me and Nick Vaughan-Williams and Richard Aldridge, the people who were helping Chris Hughes, the head of department, put the REF submission together, we're still a little bit flavour of the month with the university because they think we've done a really good job from that. But of course, that doesn't necessarily entail that we're going to do well in the actual process, because we still don't quite know what HEFCE is going to end up saying is the authoritative league table, and it could be that the university has persuaded us, for the right reasons, I have to say, has persuaded us to target the wrong league table. So it could be that for no fault of our own, we don't hit the sort of heights that the university is expecting of us. If it is deemed to be our fault, if that happens though, you could see somebody with a screwdriver taking my nameplate off my office door on the 19th of December. Given that I'll actually be away on that day at a PhD Viva in Brussels, can someone let me know if they've got rid of me without me knowing? Because that would be a nasty surprise when I came back after that weekend, if that is the case.
You might be able to get a place in Brussels then, Matt.
The words career change are the only two that come to mind in response. So how is REF organised? It's organised in, I think it's 35 or 36 what are called units of assessment, UOAs to those of us in the know, which is capital U, little O, capital A and a little S. That's how you write UOAs. And you can see where we are, because I've handily put that right in the middle. We're in panel C, which is really the social sciences, but with one or two sub-panels that you might think, are they really social sciences? Architecture, for instance, is included in panel C. Sport and exercise science, leisure and tourism, whatever that is. What an intellectual snob I am. Education as well, sometimes we think that's in arts and humanities, other times maybe in social sciences, but these are broadly the social science panel. And within the panel C, there are these 11 sub-panels, each of which really is defined by a subject area. And so as you can see, what's been weighing on my mind for the last couple of years is to think about what's going to go on in unit of assessment 21, the Politics and International Studies sub-panel. And the relationship between the panel and the sub-panel is quite interesting because the panel, overall panel C, which is made up of the heads of all of these sub-panels, is meant to come together after all the initial results have been computed to try to make sure that none of them look out of line with one another, to be an adjudicator to make sure, in particular, that no subject field has been overly generous to itself, trumpeting excellence where excellence might not be there. So there's an attempt, supposedly, to try to even the types of scores out. But if any of you know what happened to politics and international studies last time, there were huge recriminations because our panel was meaner to our subject field than pretty much every panel or every other panel in the whole of the REF process. So our overall scores were lower than just about everyone else's. Now our sub-panel said, and I have no reason to disbelieve them, that they were just applying the measures as they saw most appropriate, and they expected panel C to even everything out afterwards. But that didn't happen. So lots of universities actually put pressure on their politics departments to either shrink or close altogether on the grounds of poor REF results, which wouldn't have been poor REF results if they had been within one of the other units of assessment. We have been told, am I allowed to say this? Yeah, because this is going to be encrypted.
We haven't decided yet.
I'm not going to say it now. Okay, I move on. I don't want to say anything that puts me in legal difficulties.
Sure.
Moving on. So what is it that enables these GPAs to be generated in the first place? And here we come across for the first time these starred levels. I'm sure you've heard academics banging on about 2 stars, 3 stars, 4 stars, and wondering what any of that means. When I was a lad, that was different classifications of petrol that you would put in your car. Now, it's different gradings of academic work. And look, they all have a description and a definition, but one of the things you'll notice about those is just how subjective it all is. So 4-star is quality that is world-leading in terms of originality, significance and rigour. Okay, so what's the relationship between originality, significance and rigour? What's most important there? What would you forgive more of? And what does world-leading mean? Does world-leading mean that everyone recognises how good it is, or that it changes debates, either for a positive or negative? That it's got lots of citations? But you do know, don't you, that what the most highly cited books in politics in the last 40 years have been? Do you know this?
Textbooks,
really.
Verbo,
no,
Kane, and
no, it's Fukuyama's end of history thesis, subsequently recanted even by him, and Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. So why do they generate all of those citations?
Because people disagree.
Because everyone disagrees. it's the standard way of opening up space for yourself in the debate. Fukuyama says this, puh, etc. So it's just not obvious what world leading means. 3-star, quality that's internationally excellent in terms of originality, significance and rigour, but which falls short of the highest standards of excellence. Well, yeah, that's how the numbers 3 and 4 work in ascending order anyway, isn't it? So it doesn't really tell you anything. What it means is that so much of this is up to the discretion of the members of the panel. And the sub-panel members are all leading figures within British politics and international studies departments. I think everyone that's on the panel is a professor, which might be an issue in itself. The panel, sub-panel members are drawn from a generation that maybe still continue to thrive on a reputation for work that they did 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's not necessarily the people that are at the cutting edge now. Does this lead to more conservative tendencies within the whole rep process? If you're being judged by your peers, are you actually being judged by your peers if it's a coterie of eminent professors who are maybe in intellectual commitments slightly distanced from where the new work is being done within the profession, and certainly in age are distanced from where the new work is being done within the profession? That's something that nobody's ever managed to wrestle with, that if you are going to second large numbers of people, probably it is better to have the most experienced people there, but what effect does having experienced people and experienced people only, as the reviewers have, on the overall profile of the profession? And I just don't know what that answer is. But they have to come to a series of judgments. They will read everything that's submitted, so it's a huge task for all of them. They have to read everything that's submitted and come to a decision in their reading pairs or threes as to in which of these boundaries everything that they see falls in. And let me show you how that operates across the 3 different aspects of a ref submission. Outputs, this is publications. Now, in general terms, each academic member of staff is invited to submit 4 pieces. Where invited probably means required. So 4 pieces over a 6-year period. And so every member of staff that submitted will have each of their 4 pieces read and then graded as either 4-star, 3-star, 2-star, 1-star or unclassified. And obviously it's better to have your work graded as 4-star. And given how professionalised ref planning has become now, every institution requires all of its departments to introduce external practice referees, even at the planning stage. And we have to go very frequently to the university and report what our external referees are suggesting the scores are likely to be for each of our individual members of staff.
Who are these external reviewers?
We pick them. People who aren't on the REF panel, because they would have to say no to that. And people, again, who are well known within the profession that we think have the sort of experience to make viable judgments
and get paid
on
for
the
that.
Quality of the work and get paid for it. We forewent the upgrades of all of our computers 1 year simply to find all the money to pay for all of the external reviews that has taken place. So within that process of REF planning and the external reviews and what me and the other members of the PACE REF team had to report on a frequent basis to the university, judgments are made about whether people are going to go on to the submission or not. I don't think Warwick has been overly punitive, but certainly at other institutions, they have been saying that it's a now a standard requirement of your job that in each REF cycle, you will be able to produce things that are graded internally, plus with the external help on that grading, of at least 4 3-star pieces of work. So even though none of us actually know what the difference between 4-star, 3-star, 2-star, 1-star is, in practice, most universities, and thankfully not really ours, not at this level anyway, are using the boundary between 3-star and 2-star as some sort of disciplinary mechanism to either tell their academic staff that they're working acceptably to their terms of their contract or not. And of course, lots of people feel very threatened by that. Lots of people feel very, very destabilised in their work if they're not getting a clear message from their departmental managers that they fit above that 4-3-star line. And it's absolutely sure that when the actual REF results come out, the whole of the profession is not going to be made up of 4 3-star people and above. So there's another aspect of game playing that maybe goes on here. Who do you hide? Who do you artificially bump up their scores that you show to the university? But I didn't say that either. But you see how important the publications are. This is worth 65% of the overall REF score, because you get a profile that then gets translated into some sort of a GPA. So for our publications, we submitted, or I can't remember how many it was, probably somewhere around 220. So for those 220 publications, we will end up with a profile that will say certain percentage 4-star, certain percentage 3-star, certain percentage 2-star, and let's hope that there's nothing in any of the others. And that will go to make up our overall publications profile. But publications is not the only thing. There it is, 20%. Impact makes up 20%. Sorry, did I say 20% for publications? 65% for publications. Impact is 20%. So a fifth of our overall profile is on impact. And what Nick had to do was to write both a 4-page overarching impact summary to show what it is that we have been able to do as a department on the impact front, but also the mechanisms that we have in place for trying to generate impact, for helping train our colleagues into becoming more attuned to the whole impact agenda. Then he had to work with particular colleagues or groups of colleagues to write 6 4-page impact case studies, which revolved around certain people's or groups' work and how that work had made a demonstrable difference to the way in which some aspect of society was thought about, managed, etc. So it's very difficult to get all of this right. And we were certainly taking a step into the unknown here, because impact had not appeared in any of the previous ones. One thing that did remain the same though, and here's the final bit of it, is the environment sub-profile. And you have to talk, again, in a way that will be judged 4-star, 3-star, 2-star, 1-star, giving you a profile across that 15% that's then added to the other profiles to generate the super profile that can then get translated into your GPA, which everyone will then disagree about what the GPA figure actually means and where you fit on the overall league tables. But here are the 5 things that I had to write about for the environment document. An overview. This was just a narrative about the way that our department organises its research. In particular, Hefke now seems to insist that we all have research groups. So that's one of the reasons that we have our clusters. The reason is because they're a good thing in their own right, of course. But that's one of the reasons. The second big subsection is research strategy. So how we manage research, how we incentivise research, how we produce research and allow our colleagues and also our PhD students to hit a number of different research objectives at the same time. Because research is now understood much more broadly in academic terms than it used to be. When I started, when I was sitting in the position that you are now, research just meant writing and publishing. And now it means attracting grants, building research teams, and knowing how to manage research, public engagement, impact, dare I say. So all of these things have been added to what research means. So research isn't just writing anymore. Then there is a section on people where we can start to talk about our staffing strategy. There's also a section about you there, specifically about you, research student. You are people, you will be glad to know in Hefke's eyes, in the same way that we're people. Then there's a section about income, infrastructure and facilities. Never quite knew what to say about that, apart from, oh, look at us, we're awash in cash. And if only that were true, really. And the final one, collaboration and contribution to the discipline of the research base. What we think we do to help politics and international studies as a profession in this country be more viable, be more active and be more vibrant than it might otherwise be in our absence. So that's the way that the overall REF profile works and the way that the overall REF process works. Here's one thing that might interest you, and I'm coming to the end now. This is the reductions that may be applied for early career researchers. Because in general, the expectation is that you will submit four pieces of work, but that only applies to people who have been in post, meaning in their first permanent lecturing post through the whole of the REF cycle. So if you were in post at the start of the REF cycle, which this one, it started on the 1st of January 2014, and if you're still in post without any breaks at all by the end of the REF cycle, which is projected to be, not confirmed yet, but projected to be the 31st of December 2019, then you are required to submit four pieces of work. You can claim reductions if you've had any period away from normal employment, for maternity leave perhaps, for illness, but they're quite strict about that and how long you must have been away from work for to be able to qualify. The other qualification for reduction is for early year researchers, and this is how it worked last time. We're assuming this is going to be the model again, but given that one, REF or REE changes every time, often in unpredictable ways, and two, they never tell us what the rules of the game are until we're three quarters of the way through the game. This was published, does it say on here somewhere, March 2012, for a November 2013 submission. So we've been 4.5 years into the 6-year cycle before they managed to tell us what the reductions were for early career researchers. So one of the ways that you'll be able to do this to work out how it might apply to you, given when it is that you get your first academic post, is just to add 6 onto these dates. So it might be, for instance, or it's likely to be, that if you're appointed to your first lectureship on or before the 31st of July 2015, you're eligible for no reductions at all. So you'd have to submit 4 pieces like everyone else. Knowing these dates can be quite useful, actually, because it might be possible to ask your new employer, if they were considering employing you on the 31st of July, it would be worth volunteering, being paid for one fewer day, and saying, can I be employed from the 1st of August, please? Because that makes REF planning easier. But that's when you do probably have to be a walking encyclopedia of REFness to know to ask in the first place. I'm going to allow all of the slides to be made available to you all, so don't worry about that. But you see how it's staggered between when you start and how many reductions that you might get. So that might be something for you to bear in mind. You'll be still classified as early career researchers for REF 2020. And we call it REF 2020 even though the REF window closes on the 31st of December 2019, because the REF is numbered after the year in which the results come out, not the year in which the cycle closes. So, there might not have been any words of wisdom, which this slide seems to take for granted that there have been, doesn't it? So the last few words of wisdom would look like this, as you're all struggling to stay awake. I really do want to emphasise this aspect of not allowing REF to become something bigger in your mind than it actually is. I think you do have to be aware of it. You do have to work out how you fit in with the REF cycle. But I don't think it's anything that should keep you awake at night. I put here, for the benefit of the people listening on the tape, that the people that cope best with the demands of REF are the people who are able to take the whole process in their stride. The people that don't actually have to do anything different at all. Who are just getting on with their job, getting their publications out, writing their articles, writing their books, doing all the other things anyway, because that's what they think the job's about. And if you take care of all of those individual aspects of the job, then REF takes care of itself. So REF is something that you can feel at least a little bit detached from. Won't stop you using the language of REF, won't stop you talking in the corridors in frustrated terms with colleagues about REF, but at the same time it shouldn't be something that impacts upon you. If you can take care of all of those individual components of the job, then REF does look after itself. Here's a piece of advice I have for thinking about what your four, or it might be three or two or one, REF pieces should look like. I don't think that you should consider writing anything specifically for REF. There isn't anything that looks like a better or worse REF submission. You should just write what it is that you're most interested in, and trust the intrinsic quality of that piece of work. And also to trust that it will be recognised by the reviewers. You have no idea who it is that's going to be appointed to the subpanel. That will only take place about 2 years before the REF window closes. And even then, you might have a little bit of an idea of who's likely to be reading your work, but you won't know for sure, because they cross-check people between actual experts in that area and semi-experts in that area, just to make sure that there's a fairness in the reading. Process. I also don't think that it's possible to visualise what a REF publication would look like and then go about thinking that that's the template and trying to replicate the template. So I know I've said this before, but I'm going to continue to stress it. Just write what you would do anyway, and then everything else will fall into place. Develop for yourself a reputation for writing interesting stuff on your own research interests, and then REF doesn't become a problem at all. That's the way in which it's possible to take it in your stride. I think the same is true of impact and environment, looking further down the line as well. The academic job grows the more length of time that you've been in it. More people demand more things of you. So enjoy the relative sanctity of the first few years in an academic post, where you are allowed to focus a lot on your own research. But when it comes to people knocking on your door in 10 years' time, talking about impact and environment, don't go and do anything special for that. Find ways of doing things that you would want to do in any case, because you think that they're important, or that they respond to what you think the public role of an academic should be. And then think of impact language to describe what it is that you've done. Don't think of something new to do that you wouldn't have done otherwise just because you think that fits impact. Make impact fit the things that you want to do, the things that you find most rewarding from the job. Because one of the things that REF should never do is take away that intrinsic reward that we get from the privilege of doing academic work, and of being able to work with people within the community more broadly as well. So here's my very final thought. REF sometimes annoys me A lot of the paperwork that I have to do for REF annoys me intensely. But it hasn't changed my perspective on the job that I have. I can't imagine ever having a better, more fulfilling and more rewarding job than the academic post that I hold. And I don't think there's anything that REF could ever do to change my mind on that. So don't allow REF to put you off following an academic career if it's an academic career that you want to follow. Just make sure that REF becomes manageable within the terms of what it is that you want to do in your academic career. And that's the end. That's all I know.
Thank you.